The Google Podcast app is going away in April. Right now, I want you to take a look at the podcast app you're using right now. Maybe it's time for a new one. Check out podcastapps.com and try a new one for free right now. That's podcastapps.com.
Hi, I'm Jay Van Bavel. I'm a professor of psychology and neuroscience at New York University and the author of The Power of Us, and I'm ready to start digging deep.
Welcome to Digging Deep, presented by Zen Books and Abacus Data. I'm Mark Sutcliffe, and I'm on a quest to learn from the best. A few months ago, I was out for a run, and I was listening to a podcast, just like you are right now. And the guest was a really interesting professor from New York University named Jay Van Bavel. Jay is an internationally recognized expert and author. But what really caught my attention is that he started talking about a study that he'd been involved in that happened in the Byward Market in Ottawa. And I live in Ottawa, only a few miles from the Byward Market. So I felt this instant connection to Jay. And that's exactly the kind of connection that Jay researches and writes about. His work is in the area of how group identity shapes our minds, our brains, and our behaviors. I could relate to Jay because he and I are both Canadian. We share an identity. And identities define us. They often bring us together and give us common goals. But as we've seen recently, identity can also drive deep divisions. And here's just one example. We have this idea that everyone starts out with an open mind, a clean slate. And we all gather and analyze data and then make informed judgments about what we should do, whether it's consumer behavior or how we're going to vote. And then maybe we join up with other people who have formed the same opinions. But the truth is often exactly the opposite. We align ourselves with people first. We achieve that group identity. And then those relationships, and not any new information, are actually what drive our opinions. Jay is going to share with us all the benefits and risks of being part of a group, how it can make us better and healthier, but also leave us vulnerable to all kinds of different things, like groupthink, for example. We're going to talk about how cooperation and communication are part of our evolution and how strong leadership means building a sense of cohesion among your team. And Jay reminds us of something really important, that while we often look at how others influence us and our behavior, we also need to think about the influence that we are having on those around us. He also offers insight into why so many of us fail to meet our goals when we try to go it alone. We also talk about the profound impact of having children, why he lost his optimism about social media, and how a small town kid from Canada who wanted to be Clarice Starling, you know, from Silence of the Lambs, ended up teaching one of the most popular courses at New York University. Now, Jay is not your average Manhattanite professor, and this is not your average conversation. You can listen in as he tells us why choosing the right group is the most important decision you'll make in your life, how identity shapes our response to tragedy, and also why a piece of cubed cheese almost killed him, but also helped him form a much deeper relationship with another academic who would become his research partner and co-author. Together with Dominic Packer, the guy who helped him with the cube of cheese, Jay has written The Power of Us, Harnessing Our Shared Identities for Personal and Collective Success. All right, one last thing before we get started. If you enjoy this podcast, I'd really appreciate it if you would subscribe and also post a review on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen. And if you haven't done so already, please subscribe to my weekly newsletter. It's called The Weekly Dig. It's very quick. It's a two-minute read. It has five really useful lessons that you can apply to your life and to your work. Lots of people are reading it every week and enjoying it, so please give it a try. You can subscribe at letsdigdeep.com. That's letsdigdeep.com. Now, let's start digging deep with the co-author of The Power of Us, Jay Van Bavel. Jay, it's a real pleasure to welcome you to Digging Deep. Thank you so much for joining us. And we're going to get into the story of how I got to know your work a little bit later, but it's kind of funny because it's actually an example of what you describe. Because what drew me to you is I'm listening to a podcast and, hey, there's this Canadian guy on it who's talking about Ottawa. And that's exactly the kind of connection that you write about. So we'll be exploring a lot of that kind of stuff and what it means coming up. But first of all, welcome. Thank you for doing this.
Thank you so much for having me. I'd love to have a Canadian audience.
Yeah. So let's start by getting to know you a little bit more. What would you say is your fondest childhood memory?
I think my fondest childhood memory was probably winning a hockey tournament when I was a kid. I must have been like 12 or 13. And, you know, it's just so much fun and you're celebrating as a team. And, you know, growing up in Canada, it's hard to beat that.
Yeah, for sure. I have a 12-year-old son and he played, yeah. You know, he was just talking yesterday about a hockey tournament he played in just before COVID and how much he misses that.
Yeah.
Who was your hero when you were 10 years old?
Yeah. So I grew up in Northern Alberta. And when I was 10, I'm pretty sure the Oilers were the best team in the world, maybe the best hockey team in history. And I was a goalie. So Grant Fear was my hero. It's hard to top that.
Yeah. Okay. What did you think you were going to be when you grew up?
By the time I was in high school, I was hoping to be a criminologist. I actually wanted, if you've ever seen Silence of the Lambs, I really wanted to be Clarice Starling and track down like serial killers. For some reason that movie really like had an effect on me when I was a teenager. When I got to college at University of Alberta, I applied twice to the criminology program and got rejected both times. It was super competitive. And so I'm basically on my plan B. I ended up becoming a psychologist instead and fell in love with it. So I'm essentially a failed profiler.
Yeah. Wow. The world had a different plan for you. But yeah, that's interesting. What would you say is your life story in 6 words?
Small town kid exceeds expectations. I am living a life that I never expected for myself. Almost every stage I've gone to has gone better than I had hoped. And so I kind of never expected to get a PhD or be a professor or write a book, and kind of all of those things have come true in ways that are always surprising to me. I'm always like, whoa, I wake up and I don't know how I got here.
Yeah, that's great. For what do you feel most grateful?
I think I feel grateful for having really supportive parents growing up. I was a first generation college student and, you know, I came from a place that was very blue collar, and I didn't really know what was out there for me. And I think I just had parents who always just supported me to do whatever I wanted to do and helped me find the things that I was good at and was passionate about and supported me kind of unconditionally. So I think that's probably been my biggest, thing that I'm grateful for in the world.
Yeah. That's beautiful. What's been the best year of your life so far and why?
Huh? I think maybe the best year of my life would have definitely been before the pandemic. I have to say last couple of years have been the worst. I've kind of enjoyed all. I'm a pretty optimistic, happy person. I tend to enjoy all the places I've lived, all the years I've had. But maybe the best year of my life was probably my first year of college. Just moving. I moved from a small town to Edmonton, Alberta, and lived with my friends. And we just had a relentless amount of fun and met all kinds of interesting new people. And so it's hard to top that.
And what's been the toughest year of your life? Has it been the last period with COVID?
Yeah, I think COVID, so I had 2 kids who were small kids and they were at home in elementary school and I was trying to teach them. I had gotten this contract for this book, which was due during COVID, which I didn't expect to have to write it while I was homeschooling and trapped in my house. Yeah. New York was hit worst in the world. We were the ground, you know, one of the worst spots in the world. Everything was shut down and it was really devastating here and stressful and traumatic. And then the other thing that happened at the time, I started doing all this research on COVID because I study groups and collective behavior and wrote a paper on COVID. And it got, you know, I had to present it to staff in the Senate and Congress and the White House and the World Health Organization. And so it was just all of these things that any one of them would have been a lot to handle on top of like doing my normal job and my normal life. And all of them hit at the same time. And so I have to say, it's just an overwhelming year of challenges that I've been trying to overcome and keep all the balls in there.
Yeah.
Do my best not to drop any of them.
And you managed to get the book out. I, I can't think of anything worse than trying to write a book while you're looking after two kids. Like, what could be more incompatible than those two things?
Yeah, it was writing and thinking while you're trying to like help your kid log into their virtual school and like help, and they can't, like, they don't even know how to use email, right? My kids are little. And so it was tough. A lot of evenings and early mornings trying to write around all that stuff. But I have to say, it's all downhill from here. So I'm glad it's out, and we're kind of mostly through it, and we're all, you know, hopefully the vaccine for the kids will come out in the next 2 weeks, and my stresses will start to
go away. What one person has had the greatest impact on your life?
Oh goodness, that's a great great question. I think the person that's had the most impact, maybe the people, would be my kids, Jack and Annie. I always thought like everybody has kids, but I have to say there's nothing more radical than having kids. It completely changes your life from the moment they're born in terms of your sleeping, your behavior, and in terms of the themes of my book, which is about identity. Being a dad was something I didn't really anticipate, and it just like changes how you think about so much of the world. Like the moment I come home, all my other identities and commitments kind of go to the back of my mind, and I'm there like talking to my kid, picking them up from school, making them dinner. And they don't really care about what happens. They don't care as much about what happens at work or those things. They like want your attention on what they're going through. And it's been so challenging, but so rewarding.
Yeah. That's interesting. Cause I think that's a great answer to that question. Because especially in the context of what you write about with regard to identity, cause it's like, all of a sudden you get this new word to describe yourself, parent, dad, mom, whatever. And not a lot of people answer that, you know, they tend to think more about people who have impacted their career or their parents or that kind of thing, but your kids really redefine you in a lot of ways, right?
It fundamentally changes who you are. So I'll give you an example. I mean, in addition to the pandemic story I told you last night, my daughter was feeling a little ill before bed. And, you know, I was going to do some work or do a call to a friend. I had to shut it all down and take care of her and then put her to bed, and she was fine. And then I was going to go to bed like an hour or two later. And lights were off. I was about to fall asleep. And I was like, I got to check on her. You know, I'm just like, as a dad, I have to. It's like my duty to do it. And I checked on her and she was fast asleep. It was fine. But it's like that just dominates so much of your thoughts, and it fundamentally changes who you are in a way that's so deep and pervasive and life altering, and it will be with me until the day I die. And so nothing will top that in terms of what affects you. It's hard to imagine. Sure. And I've had lots of experiences in my life in lots of different ways and met lots of different people, but how could anyone change you more than your kid?
It's so true. What's the most important lesson you've learned that you would share with other people?
I think the most important lesson that I've learned is about intellectual humility and growth. So I'll go back to the hockey as like probably a 13 or 14 year old. So on this hockey team, I had this great hockey coach, Johnny Cook, still keep in touch with him, you know, 30 years later. And I remember after one of our games, he brought us all into the hallway out of the locker room one at a time to tell us all of our strengths and our weaknesses and areas for growth. And he scored us all in like athleticism, leadership, something else. And I came out and I scored okay on athleticism and better on leadership. And he said, your biggest strength is that you take criticism better than anybody on the team. And I remember thinking, that's a dumb strength to have. You know, I wanted to be like one of the best jocks or the best leaders in the locker room. And he said, no matter what I tell you, you're always like soaking it up and learning and getting better. And you love to do that. And I have to say, over my life, that has been my superpower, is that I love to like take critical feedback and get better. And I didn't think it was a very good thing at the time. When you're 14, that's not a cool thing to have. But now that I'm in my 40s, I'm like, that actually was the most accurate and useful feedback I got, and mattered more in life than anything that else that he could have told me. So that was like something I would pass on to others, is just like embrace learning and growth and make that part of your identity and who you are, and attach yourself to identities that help you grow in groups. Because I'll say one thing, it's not in the book, but most people set goals, like their New Year's resolutions, right? To quit smoking or lose weight or exercise more. But we fail at most of those. Most people fail within a couple of weeks at their New Year's resolutions, even though that's the single most important goal for them in the whole year.
Yeah.
And they set it themselves, not someone telling them to do this usually. It's their own goal and they still can't achieve it. Most of our goals are achieved effectively when we're part of groups. So if you're more likely to work out if you have a workout buddy, more likely to go running if you have a running group, more likely to eat healthy if your rest of your family starts eating healthy or your friends at work are going to a healthy restaurant for lunch. And so really the key is about joining groups that make us better, healthier. And so I think that that's like the fundamental thing is it's easy to want to do this, but it works much better if you're part of groups and share identities where that's valued.
Yeah. Surround yourself with people who have the same objectives or who are even better than you. But the other part of that that I think is important is for you as an academic, as an author, is if you want to put out a great book, you've got to do a bunch of work and then share it with people and get them to tell you what's wrong with it, right? And listen to that and incorporate that into your thinking and put that book through the refinery, basically, in order to get something that's great at the end of that, right?
Yeah, I mean, and one of the great things about my job in science, it's a lot of people hate it. A lot of people hate this job because every time you do a study, you've got to present it in front of a group, it gets torn apart, then you submit it to a journal to get published and it gets torn apart by an editor and three reviewers who are anonymous. You don't even get to see these people. And that way they can be totally blunt with you. And often it goes through multiple rounds of different journals before it gets in anywhere. And so I went through about 18 years of that nonstop to get to this book. And so it turned out to be, you know, rough treading, exhausting at times, but by the end of it, you get the payoff of it. And it's so wonderful because you've already been criticized on so many things for every piece of it. And that criticism now just like washes off me so nicely because I'm so used to it. And so it's kind of the product of thinking about these things, going to talks, reading papers and articles and other books about it, and then trying to also make it fun so that anybody could read it. So it turns out that that's often the hardest part for scientists. Sure. Is a lot of us aren't trained writers. But I think that's like, if it landed with you and if it lands with a broad audience, that's really actually what I care about.
Yeah. But I always say to people, you know, would you rather hear the criticism? And I'm going to use a book as an example, but it could be any finished product. Would you rather hear the criticism after the product's been produced and released or before when you've got a chance to improve it, right? And it's hard for us to let go and hear the criticism and make the changes and fix it. But it's always better than, in the example of a book, putting out a book and it gets really bad reviews. Oh. You'd rather get those bad reviews first, right?
Yeah. So this is something that we embraced, and we've gotten a couple reviews and we're both glowing. One was from a scientist, so we know the scientists all, and one was from like Publishers Weekly, who gave it a starred review, which very few books get. So we know like that it's good for like librarians and bookstores and average readers. I'll say my favorite review though, was I have this 11-year-old neighbor. My daughter, who's 9, has another little girlfriend who's I think 8, and her older brother Leo knew I was writing this book and asked if he could read it. And I gave him a free copy. I said, I'll read it if you review it. And then a couple of days ago, I ran into him. He had read the whole thing and gave a review. I posted it on our book TikTok account. But he loved it. He gave it a 9.7 out of 10. And he said it was the first ever psychology book he's ever read. And he's 11. And so I'm like, if an 11-year-old can read it and like it, and my esteemed colleague can write a review in the top scientific journal in the world and likes it, I said, we've hit all our audiences now.
Yeah, that's a home run. That's
that was the review awesome. I cared about the most.
Yeah.
My 11-year-old.
What would people be most surprised to learn about you?
Oh, goodness. I think the most surprising thing if they met me probably would be if they had a stereotype. So we have stereotypes of groups. If they had a stereotype of like a New York professor, and then they met me and got talking to me, they'd realize probably I'm very different from your stereotype of your like ivory tower abstract professor. I'm probably like more, maybe because I came from like a blue collar rural background, I'm very different probably than like your average Manhattanite.
Yeah.
And it's kind of a funny thing. I think for me, maybe my strength is a little bit, I'm a social chameleon. So I've lived in all kinds of different places, including Toronto, Edmonton, Fox Creek, Alberta, New York City, Columbus, Ohio. And I've liked all the places. And so I think I'm somebody who is pretty adaptable in a way that you might not expect from most scientists, you know, working at a university.
Mm. What's your secret talent?
I said already, my secret talent is that I take constructive criticism very well. and I recommend other people get that talent. Sounds lame. It's not invisibility or you can't fly. You know, it's not like one of, there's no superhero in any comic book who has the superpower of like taking criticism well and growing, right? Like we did not grow up with that as like a superpower that anybody ever talked about. But I would say that's my secret superpower.
Nice. What's your boldest prediction for the future?
Oh, goodness. My boldest prediction, and this really comes in the last part of our book, the last chapter is about the future identity. And I think most of the challenges facing humanity are about putting people together in groups that get along. So most of the threats we face are inequality, massive inequality, which erodes shared purpose and identity. And that's then leading to threats to democracy in many, many countries. So many political scientists thought that democracy was the end of the road, that once you get there, no one's going to want to go back from having the right to vote and freedoms that we have in a liberal democracy. But now pretty much every liberal democracy in Europe and in the United States and maybe even Canada a little are under threat. And polls suggest people are supporting anti-democratic leaders. And that is now something that is being seriously threatened by a lack of cohesion. And I think inequality is part of it. And then the other big thing I think, and this is the existential threat, is climate change. And this is a type of identity that we need that's going to go above our national level. We need to build an identity at the global level. And that's going to be incredibly hard to do. And if we don't do it, you know, I saw a new study yesterday that 99.7% of climate scientists or something like that now think that there's a, you know, humans cause climate change and it's growing towards the level of catastrophic threat. So that's the thing that scares me the most. I also admittedly understand it the least. So I have a little bit of humility. I've tried to read climate change papers and I can't. I have a PhD and I'm a professor and I can't understand them. So but I will say you never see 99.7% yeah. consensus among scientists on anything. You would never see that for a single thing in the field of psychology or social and behavioral sciences. So that's a unique sense of every single expert who's looked at this, or almost every single one, shares this concern.
If you were giving you talk to students all the time, but if you were giving a speech at a commencement address, what would be your key message?
I think the key message is about the need to build identities with better norms. So people have tons of identities. You know, as I've said, I'm Canadian and I'm a professor, I'm a New Yorker, I'm a dad, blah, 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 blah. We all have these and we shift between them. But it's not enough to just identify with the group. The key thing is identifying with groups that have norms that guide you in the right direction. So when people think about identities, they often think about like tribalism. Like the moment that you're part of a group, it intrinsically means you're going to discriminate against outgroups. And we talk about how that happens in our book, or that you're going to be conformist to the group. But it turns out the research on this is actually way more interesting, that people who identify with groups that are inclusive become more inclusive and care more about outsiders. I'll give you a couple examples. Think of Doctors Without Borders. The moment you join that group, you're going to invest more time and consideration trying to help people who are radically different from you than you would have otherwise. And the more you identify with the group, the more you're going to care about people across the world you otherwise never connect with, or the Red Cross. And so the norms of the group are about helping other people in distress, no matter who they are. In fact, the more different than you they are, the more you care about them. That's why it's called Doctors Without Borders, right? The whole point is we don't have national identities when you're part of this group. So that's one way that groups don't need to make you tribal. They can make you actually embrace different people. The other norm that I think is really interesting is we think of Canadians a little bit like this, Americans really like this, where we're hyper individualistic here. And so you think of, you know, Americans are the land of individuals. And what the research shows is it turns out that that's also identity. The more you identify as American, the more individualistic you become. So it turns out identity is a form of individualism is a form of conformity. If you identify with groups that value individualism. And then the third thing I think I would challenge is groupthink. We often think that when you're a group, you become like a sheeple or a lemming. Or a yes man or woman. Again, what the research shows is people who dissent actually value the group the most. And so what you want to be is part of a group that has norms that value dissent and disagreement and original ideas and difference of opinion, because you'll arrive at the best conclusion that way. And so all of these are about the norms of the group matter a great deal. If you want to unlock like connecting with others and getting a lot of people different than you, if you want to, you know, think about whether you're going to be an individualistic or not, And if you want to have groups that are immune to things like groupthink. So right. I think the norms, understanding norms of groups are the key thing that the next generation, if I were to give a commencement address, have to think about how they're going to shape in the groups they're in. And most of those people are going to go on to be leaders. That leaders have to understand this. And we have a chapter on leadership in our book, embody it and cultivate environments that do these things.
So choose the right groups, right?
And choose the right groups is the most important decision I think you'll make in your life.
Wow. Has there been a recent epiphany for you, something that you've changed your mind about or a recent discovery?
Yeah, I mean, I am one of those people who changes my mind on a weekly basis based on evidence as I get it. I think I went from pretty optimistic. The biggest change I've had is I went to optimistic about the role of the internet and social media in our lives, thinking it was going to promote democracy and connection with different people, allow more wider diversity of voices. And now I'm increasingly pessimistic. I think the more data I get on that, and the more there's a whistleblower for Facebook who came out and testified against them last week in Congress here in the US about how it's polarizing people and fomenting division and hate. And our data and other labs are finding this more and more. So I went from pretty optimistic about it originally to then optimistic, at least that the leaders, when they got this evidence, would be able to change it. You know, somebody like Mark Zuckerberg could change the algorithms tomorrow in a way that promotes better social or societal outcomes. But I've been wrong about both those. And in fact, it seems like the data I'm getting, because I study social media and the data that the whistleblower is talking about, and then the reaction of people like Zuckerberg has all signaled that it's way more negative and that they're not going to do anything about it.
Wow. Okay.
Or they're going to do stuff, but not anything that would actually make a substantial change.
I'm going to try to talk more about that coming up. We're gonna also talk in detail about the theme of your book and the lessons of your book. But is there a book that's had a big impact on you? Is there a book that you're most likely to recommend to other people?
There's so many books. Maybe the first one that had a huge impact on me was called The Nature of Prejudice. It was written, I think, in 1954 by Gordon Allport. He was a Harvard psychologist who wrote about prejudice. He wrote this book. No one bought it for a whole year. And then the year, you know, when you write a hardcover book, after a year, they allow you to turn it into like a softcover trade book. And so he deleted 100 pages, I learned, and it became a bestseller. And he took out most of the jargon and made it accessible. And so I recently learned it was considered the first psychology best-selling trade book of all time. And it's still selling reprints, you know, we're now, what, almost 70 years later. And that book really opened my, I read my first year of my PhD, and it really opened my eyes to prejudice and how it works and set me on a path of trying to understand groups and conflict in a way that is impossible to reverse. So I could probably name 100 books that have influenced me, but it's hard to change that kind of one of those first big ones that really changed how you thought about the world and understood things.
All right, Jay, thank you for answering those questions. We're going to take a short pause, and in just a moment, we will continue digging deep with Jay Van Babel. We're just going to take a quick break so I can tell you a little bit more about the presenting sponsor of Digging Deep, ZenBooks. ZenBooks is Canada's go-to cloud accounting firm. They are not your typical accounting firm. I know the founders, Colin and Eric. I've worked with them for several years. And here's why I think you should consider working with them too. First of all, they bring a fresh, unique, modern approach to what is a very old-fashioned industry. These guys were working remotely and in the cloud long before it became cool. ZenBooks also uses technology to your advantage. I think this is really important. They give you the tools and analysis you need to monitor your business in real time. That's so valuable right now when everything changes so quickly. Yes, they're a virtual accounting firm, but that doesn't mean they're offshore, and it doesn't mean they're inattentive. ZenBooks combines the efficiency and effectiveness of a cloud accounting service with all the benefits that you'd want from a trusted advisor, high-level advice, and strategic support. Now, here's what I think is going to happen if you work with ZenBooks. You'll probably start out taking advantage of their cutting-edge cloud accounting solutions, but in the long run, I think you'll stay with them because of their strategic guidance and problem-solving. Among their core values, they specifically list being candid and proactive. Isn't that exactly what you want from a trusted advisor? Look, even if you're already working with an accountant or a bookkeeper, or you have some accounting staff on your team, I think you should still talk to ZenBooks and learn more about their tools and their expertise. Check out ZenBooks at zenbooks.ca. That's zenbooks.ca. Digging Deep is all about helping you make better decisions, and so is Abacus Data. Most leaders struggle to connect with and engage their audiences. Why is that? It's because they aren't sure how they think and feel and how they will react. Abacus Data can give you the strategic insights you need to make better decisions and to make them confidently. Here's a good example. A major national union was recently negotiating a new agreement for its thousands of members. This had the potential to be a very difficult process. There were many competing interests. So they brought in Abacus Data to conduct thorough and detailed research of their members to learn exactly where they stood, what they were thinking, what they wanted. And as a result, they were able to secure a strong new deal that was accepted overwhelmingly in a national vote. Abacus Data helps all of its clients understand what's really happening in the minds of their employees, clients, and stakeholders. They help them avoid costly blind spots. And they're really good at what they do. In fact, Abacus Data was one of the most accurate pollsters in the 2019 Canadian federal election. Make the one decision that will improve all of your other decisions. Let Abacus Data help you move forward with confidence and clarity. Go to abacusdata.ca. That's abacusdata.ca. So, Jay, there's so much that we're going to talk about, the themes of your book and how they apply to our lives, the organizations we lead, and our society. There's a lot, obviously, that relates to politics and the future of our world and how we get along with each other. But could you start by talking about the experiment that you did in the Byward Market involving honey and maple syrup? So I'm here in Ottawa, you're in New York. I'm not far from the Byward Market in Ottawa, and this is just a classically kind of Canadian experiment.
Yeah, so I have been interested for many years in how identity shapes the way that we think about the world in all kinds of ways. And so the way we think about identity is very much like lenses. Like you put on like a sunglass, pair of sunglasses, and it filters the way that you're seeing the world in ways that change your interpretation of it and your behavior. And so we wanted to look at how this affects all kinds of different senses. You know, we have a study on your sense of smell. We've looked at how people change visual attention. We wanted to look at how it might change your sense of taste. And so to do this, we cued in on a taste that we know is really highly relevant to Canadian identity. So if you look on the Canadian national flag, you see the maple leaf, right, from the maple tree. And so maple syrup turns out to be a really powerful symbol of Canadian identity. In fact, I always like this fact. This factoid, Canada has a strategic reserve, a national strategic reserve of maple syrup. You know, the US, we have a national strategic reserve here of like petroleum or oil or something in case there's like a war. In Canada, it's maple syrup. So it's just kind of, and by the way, that was knocked off a few years. There's a massive like heist of this national strategic reserve of maple syrup. I think it's in Quebec. And so this is something really central to Canadian identity. And if you go buy maple syrup, if you're going through customs, between Canada, you know, the duty free store, they always have like maple syrup with a big Canadian maple leaf on it. You can buy it, bring it to the US when you're coming from Canada.
Yeah. And so, some of the bottles are even shaped like maple leaves, the bottles themselves. Yeah.
It's other than like beer and hockey, I think like the maple syrup is might be like Canada's next biggest like national identity. Yeah. They add the beaver in there. And so we had this taste test essentially, or this sampling taste test, where we had a small amount of honey, which tastes delicious and looks a lot like maple syrup when you put it in a little jar, and maple syrup side by side. And we had Canadians walking by in the Byward Market come and taste them both and rate them both. And in one condition, we activated their individual identity. We had them think about like books and movies they liked as an individual. And then we would have them do this little taste test, taste both and rate them both. And when they're rating them both, I think in that study, we found that people liked them pretty similarly. Maybe they liked the honey a teeny bit more. And then we had another condition. So we had flipped the coin and had them do the taste test where they're thinking about their personal identity. Another condition where we had them thinking about their Canadian identity. So they had to write about like books and movies that Canadians like. And when people do that, they often don't write the same thing that they write for themselves, even though they're all Canadians. And in that condition, they liked the maple syrup more than the honey. And so they're doing this. And by the way, they don't necessarily know this is maple syrup. These are in these little jars, but they can sense the taste from maple syrup. They're familiar with it. And it's linked to their identity in their mind. And when they taste it, they just like it more. And so what this is suggesting is that this filtering that our identities are doing is happening in all kinds of the way that we're interpreting all kinds of information from different senses, including the information coming in through our mouths on our taste buds, and making us prefer foods that are connected to our identity. So this was one of my favorite studies. It was run by my friend who's a professor at Carleton University, Michael Wall, and his lab. And so it was fun to do a study out in the real world at the Byward Market with a taste test with maple syrup.
Yeah, and what that made me think about immediately is beer, right? Because beer is an acquired taste, and I think what drives people to drink beer, in a lot of cases, is not I'm going to drink beer and by myself and I just love the way it tastes, and so I'm going to keep drinking beer, but I want to hang out with a group of people and they all drink beer. So I need to start liking beer to be accepted into that group. Is that a parallel example in a way?
Yeah, I mean, beer. So I'll give you a couple stories about beer. So one we talk about in our book, which was part of the inspiration for this study, was a very famous commercial made by Molson Canadian. It was called The Rant, where this guy gets up and he's wearing like a plaid. He gets up and just starting talking quietly at first about the things that are symbols of Canada, like the beaver's a noble animal. I think he uses the word Chesterfield, not couch. And shows a picture of the Canadian flag in the background. And so he's fundamentally articulating the Canadian identity against the American identity. He says it's Z, not Z. And so this rant went viral. In fact, it won a Canadian award for writing because it became such a really powerful symbol of Canadian identity at the time when I was a teenager growing up. And when this happened, I remember people just like buying Molson Canadian beer and getting tattoos of like the flag or the leaf from like the Molson Canadian logo on their bodies, my friends. The stock of Molson Canadian or Molson shot up in part, I think, because of this, because sales were so robust. And this was just such a symbol of identity. He articulated something that Canadians often have a hard time doing, which is, what is our identity? Because we're right next to America, which dominates culture, dominates music and movies and TV. This is why you have rules in Canada around like a certain amount of Canadian content has to play on the radio. We're worried about completely getting taken over by American culture and the military dominance of the US. And so he did something really powerful. He distinguished the US from Canada and described what it means to be Canadian in a way that allowed that beer to be a symbol of Canadian. I mean, it was already called Molson Canadian, right? So Molson clearly had this in mind when they branded the beer. Beer works in all kinds of different ways, right? So I have a couple other friends from Alberta, and when they wanted to select a roommate when they were in college, it was in Red Deer College. They had a taste test for their roommates. So they had people come in and interview for their roommate, and they had a little mini beer fridge, and they had three beers in there. And I think one was like a Big Rock, which is like a microbrew in Alberta. And then there was like a mainstream, you know, Canadian beer, and then some other beer that they didn't like. And they picked the person who picked the Big Rock, because that signaled to them that that person would fit in with them and share their identities as people who like microbrew. And so there's all kinds of ways that what we drink signals our identity to other people. And national identity is one of it, but there's all these other like local community or provincial identities or city identities with the local brew that everybody drinks that are powerful for fitting in. And this is not just Canada. I went to Germany once and I had a friend who was an exchange student when I grew up, and I went to visit him in Germany when I was 19. And his family actually had owned this brewery in Germany, and it was a small brewery, but it served like the local 10-mile radius of small towns. Every bar you'd go there would have this, it was called Westheimer beer. And that's what all the locals in that tiny area of Germany drank. And so in a lot of countries, there's local beers that signal your identity with that that area or province or whatever. And so alcohol is a really powerful way of signaling our identity in all kinds of ways around the world.
And so why do we need this connection? What's at the heart of that? Because, for example, one of the reasons I got excited about talking to you is because I heard you talk about being Canadian on another podcast and about some of the experiments you'd done in Canada. And there's this, I remember, I think we all have these stories, but I remember being in the north of England visiting family one time in this small town. And I heard somebody in the distance say, "Car," like the way you do when you're playing road hockey and you need to move the net out of the way.
Yeah.
And I went running towards them, and they were from Canada too. And I felt this great connection. And if I'd heard that on the streets of Ottawa, of course, it would have been no big deal, but because I was away from home and I encountered another Canadian, and I, there's this tendency we have too, to when we meet somebody new, to kind of look for, what do we have in common? Do you know this guy at this place? And, oh, where are you from originally? Oh, I know somebody from there. Like to almost say, hey, you can trust me because we have something in common, and therefore we come from the same tribe, or we see the world the same way. Is that what's going on?
Yeah. I mean, so one of the reasons that we signal our identity to the world, and one of the easiest ways to do that now is social media. You can put all your identities on your bio on Facebook or Twitter or Instagram. It's signaling for people to know you're an ally or a friend or share something with them. And people put their little flag of their country if their national identity is important. In the US right now, they put their political identity. So they're more, and that's happening more over the last few years than ever before, because that's the big identity here that seems to matter to most people. But when I was growing up, I did my first ever trip outside of Canada. I was a tour group that we fundraised for, went to Italy when I was 17. And my mom, I remember telling me, you got to put a Canadian flag on your backpack. And I at the time, I always thought it was like to signal because other people in other countries like Canadians. But it turned out it was really an identity signal to fellow Canadians. So I was at a McDonald's in Venice. I'm in one of the places with countries the best food in the world. I go to McDonald's, right? Because I'm like this Canadian kid. And so I'm at McDonald's in Venice, and I'm wearing a Canadian maple leaf on my sweater. And this girl who's teenage girl my age comes up and just starts talking to me in English, right? Where everybody else is talking in Italian. And we hit it off and spent the whole day together. And she knew I was Canadian because she saw the maple leaf. And so she knew not only that she could connect with me, but that we'd speak the same language. And when you're abroad, that's really important. And so that never would have happened if I was like in Toronto downtown and I had that same sweater. No, if I was a teenager, no teenage girl would have come up and just talked to me about that, right? It would have been so common. But because it's distinctive, one of the things about identity, that identities matter to us when they're distinctive, when they signal there's something special about us that's different from other people. And that's why when you're traveling abroad, you see somebody from Canada, they could be from halfway across the country, you'll connect with them in a way that you wouldn't if you saw them in your local Byward Market, right? And so this is like a fundamental part of the way identity works. It serves as like a little bat signal, like, the Commissioner Gordon and all the Batman shows puts the bat in the sky and then Batman comes. We're doing that all the time with all kinds of identities. When you travel, it's with that Canadian leaf. But in our book, we talk about how this works economically. Like Apple built this into their products so that when you open a MacBook, an Apple laptop, the Apple looks upside down to the person who owns the laptop. But so you flip it up, the Apple is right side up to people who see you, because it's essentially serving as a signal to people around you that you're a Mac user. And that allows you to send an effective signal out to other people. And so Apple designed their product specifically with that. In fact, they give you a little sticker with every Apple product you buy. It has no function except for to put it on your car or your bike or your office cubicle to signal to people that you're a Mac user. And that might sound dumb, but my co-author Dominic found that even on his university campus, Mac versus PC was the fourth most important identity that college students had. We might think that's a pretty minor thing, but people really have built these identities around this product. When I grew up in Alberta, it was what type of truck you bought. It was, are you a Ford or a GMC or Dodge? And among guys, man, that was like just the ultimate like constant argument and status symbol. And they had stickers of like Calvin and Hobbes, like peeing on a symbol of whatever truck they don't like on their truck. And it's like, you think that these things are mundane things, but companies know this and they are constantly exploiting our identity in ways that are profitable for them. They create this conflict.
So what's at the heart of that? I assume it has to do with the idea that, you know, we don't exist in the world as individuals. We and our survival depended on traveling as groups, and you had to trust the other people in your group and not have to constantly reevaluate whether somebody was trustworthy, right? You just wanted to be able to say, hey, if we have this in common, then I know I can trust you. You know you can trust me, and we don't have to keep thinking about that.
Yeah, I would say that this is part of our DNA, right? So we have these brains that are really evolutionarily old. They haven't changed much in the last 10,000 years or last 100 years for sure. They were built in the previous several hundred thousand years in the African savanna. And humans can't fly. We're not poisonous. We're not camouflage. We don't run particularly fast. So we'd get picked off by all kinds of predators. What's our evolutionary advantage? It's cooperation and communication, that we worked in small groups to help each other survive. And if we were kicked out of the group, we died. We got picked off by predators. And that's why today getting kicked out of a group you care about is deeply troubling to people. It's upsetting. It can make them have mental health problems. If you get ostracized from a group and told no one wants to work with you, your IQ plummets by about 15 points in studies. Comes back eventually, but in the short term, it plummets. Everybody's been kicked out of a group or bullied as a kid, and they know what that feeling is like. And so we are the evolutionary ancestors of people who could fit in and cooperate. That's us. That's our brains. We're all the people who couldn't do that didn't make it this far. And so our brains are fundamentally attuned to finding people who are part of us, who we can trust and cooperate with. And that takes all kinds of forms. Like I said, it can take your identification with truck brands or Apple or PC or your national identity. It takes all kinds of forms, but that's basically, if you think of like what our brains are designed to do, that's one of the core functions of our brain. And that's who we are. We carry that around with us everywhere. That's part of, and it gets triggered very easily. So in my lab, we've run many studies where you flip a coin and put people onto teams. I do this in my classroom, and within minutes, people are identifying with their team more. They're paying more attention to in-group members. They're memorizing them better. They say they like them more. This even affects their unconscious attitudes or automatic attitudes they don't even know that they're expressing. It affects brain activity that we've measured. And so you can create these identities really easily, in part because it's baked into our human nature, I think.
Yeah, it's very easy to flip that switch, isn't it? Like I'll take my son to his baseball practice and they will divide the team into two smaller groups. This is at a practice, not a game. They'll divide them into two smaller groups, and it's not the same group every time. But within minutes, those two groups on the team become fierce rivals in the practice. And then next practice, it could be a totally different group of people, and they'll be fierce rivals, right? Yeah. In this game that they're playing within the practice.
Yeah, and that's that key thing. There's two key pieces to understanding human nature and how identity works there. The first is that we can easily carve people into groups, into us and them, but that we can easily recarve them. And so when you think of like group conflict, there's lots of studies, famous studies, as well as ones that I've run finding the same thing, that if you have two groups in conflict and you can convince them to cooperate together to compete with other groups, they do that almost instantly. And suddenly they'll take a group that they were discriminating against a moment ago and didn't want to work with, and suddenly feel highly empathic and like them and be supportive of them the moment that they think they're part of the same team. You see this in sports all the time, where you see a player get traded from one team to the other. They immediately like shift loyalties and will go to war with that team and get in fights to help support that team, put their body at risk. And so that's just like baked into who we are.
Yeah. And so is there a lesson in that if you, let's say you're leading a team and there's two people who are in conflict with each other, should you give them a project to work on together against some external threat that they then would jointly face?
Yeah. I think that's like one of the fundamentalist aspects of leadership. And so we have a chapter on leadership in our book, and we talk about most leaders, and this is where leadership coaching and stuff is often oriented. There's a million thought pieces of this posted on LinkedIn every day. It's about like building your mentoring skills. Mentoring is really important, right? And it's about like selecting good people and hiring and promotion and retention. But what is talked about way, way less, at least as far as we can tell, is about building a sense of cohesion among a team. Creating reward structures that don't just reward the best performer, but reward the collective successes of groups. In sports, you see this all the time, right? There, you incentivize your best players, they get the biggest salaries, but at the end of the year in the playoffs, they're competing for the championship. And they'll make enormous sacrifices to get that, to their body, they'll take all kinds of roles that they want superstars would otherwise not want to take, because they care about that more than anything else. And once that's salient, then that dominates everything. And the teams that can do that are obviously the most successful teams always. And so this is like a fundamental thing that you can do in any organization, and it's core to leadership. It's not just mentoring and selecting the right people, retaining, promoting them, giving them stretch goals, all those things, but it's constantly thinking about what you can do to also create rewards in addition to the individual rewards for great performance, but collective rewards for connecting together, working together, all supporting people. And I'll give you actually one of my favorite examples of this was the Canadian Space Agency, which is outside Montreal. It's like NASA, but in Canada. Brilliant, brilliant people. And when you walk in the Canadian Space Agency, you see all these like huge posters of like all the astronauts. Like Chris Hadfield is my favorite Canadian astronaut, because he always has like, he did Major Tom, you know, that great song in outer space. Yeah. So there's all these famous astronauts with book deals, and they're in the papers, and people often know their names, and they're on TV. And then they have another wall as you go deeper through the space station, and it's for unsung heroes. And unsung heroes are actually often the most critical people for the success of a launch, because if anything goes wrong, you have a catastrophe in outer space, right? And this happened with the NASA when they had the Challenger explosion. It was like the O-rings were off because they couldn't withstand a certain temperature. The launch happened with a certain temperature and the whole thing exploded. So those people are absolutely fundamental. Everything has to go right when you're thinking about doing something in outer space. And so they have a wall that recognizes the people who chip in and do the things that help the group be successful. These people will never be on TV, no book deals for them, no movie deals. But these people are the fundamental linchpins to group success. And so they give them the same amount of status internally that the astronauts get with their own wall. And so I think that like organizations need to think about this. How do you incentivize people who make sacrifices on behalf of the group? And every group knows who these people are, right? Yeah. I'll go to the hockey example. These are the people who block shots.
Yeah.
You know, they know, everybody in the locker room knows what these people's bodies look like and how covered in bruises they are and how dangerous it is and how many injuries they get. But they're doing the little things that are enormously painful for the team to be successful. And so every organization on the ground level, the senior leaders might not know who these people are, but everybody else knows who they are. And you have to find ways to reward those people, reward people for doing something that betters the group success.
So we've been talking about a lot of this in the context of the positives that arise from those connections, but there are some negatives as well. And we're seeing that play out in society today. And we can talk about that. One thing that strikes me though, is that I feel like there's this fallacy that every one of us, and whether it's the choices we make as voters, as consumers, in, you know, in choosing friends, in choosing our spouses, all of those things, that we all start out with this completely blank slate, open mind, gather information, do our research, and then make an informed decision. And then based on that informed decision, that might lead us to join a group of people who think the same way we do. When in fact, it seems like what you're saying is, it's the other way around almost. We're more likely to join a group and then make decisions based on staying in that group or what other people in the group would decide, rather than make our own decisions. Is that the case?
I think it's a little bit both way. People sort themselves into groups based on what the groups believe. You know, certain people are going to be attracted to certain political parties based on their political ideology. But once you're in the group and you have that identity, then it powerfully shapes your beliefs and behavior, and with all kinds of groups. And so I often think that both are at play, but because what group you choose is all for a lot of groups, you know, I can't choose my a lot of parts about myself, can't change my height, and a lot of other things. I can't change my race. But there are most of the groups and identities I have, I can choose. And so choosing a group becomes one of the most important decisions you can make. In fact, one of my favorite quotes is from these two economists. One of them is a Nobel Prize winner. It's from Rachel Cranton and George Akerlof. And they said, choosing your identity is the most important economic decision you'll make in your life. And so you have to think really carefully about what choice you want to make, to what group you want to join. And one of the core themes of our book is to give people agency. We want to tell them how groups influence you, so that you are more wise about choosing which groups to be a part of. And then the next piece is, if you're stuck in a group, and so let's say you're you have a job, right? You run a team, or you're part of a team. Maybe you're not a manager. You can exert influence over the group by changing the norms and by highlighting certain behaviors or certain people in ways that signal what the norms are, or embodying the norms yourself. And so you exert influence that way as well. So there's two kind of choice points in which we exert influence. One is choosing the right groups. And the other one is how we cultivate norms and leadership within the group. And so those are the two ways that you exert an enormous amount of influence. And it's often in, there's a great new book out about influence. People don't realize how much influence they have over others socially, by Vanessa Bonds. And she finds over and over again that people have enormous influence on others because of the power of things like social norms. And so we get to exert influence over others with them, without them even fully understanding, insofar as they identify with the group. If we're part of a fellow group member, we have a lot of influence over them. So think very actively and creatively about how you can cultivate the norms and values that you want in the groups that you are identified with.
Yeah. And that point you just brought up, I think, is really interesting, because there's actually, I think there's a lot of evidence that people tend to think of everything in the context of how others influence them, and rarely in the context of how they influence others, right?
Yeah. There's also a weird dynamic where we think everybody else is a sheep except for us. Yeah. Sometimes, you know, like, it's easy for us to see, there's the research we talk in our book about bias, that everybody else think, everybody can point out other people's biases. But I think it was like in the studies we reported, like 1 in 600 people said they're more biased than average. And so most people won't report their own bias, but they can see it in others. And so a lot of times we're not even aware of the dynamics that are going on and our role in it, how it's affecting us and how it's we're reacting to it in these ways.
And on that point, that one of the, you know, cause I that's one of the observations that I've had about other people, is that they're very quick to point out in the media or in politics or referees or whatever, you know, to say, oh, that, you know, that guy's biased, without seeing their own bias. And of course, one of the risks of the world being divided into groups, as much as we gain benefit from being in a group, is that we may treat people who are not in the group badly. And we may be biased towards people who are not in the group. And we see that play out in politics and in other ways. And I wonder sometimes if, you know, I think it's easy when you're describing how people behave in certain groups, it would be easy for people in the current political context and with the coronavirus pandemic to say, well, I can see that group dynamic playing out with anti-vaxxers, right? Or people who are scared to be vaccinated. And I can see that dynamic playing out with people who are defaulting to supporting Donald Trump, for example. But what I wonder about is, you know, do we not need to check ourselves to say, are we also being part of a group by being those who would point out the way the anti-vaxxers are in a group, and using, and, you know, sort of confirming our opinions about anti-vaxxers or people who resist vaccination? Or are we kind of part of a group by pointing out how clueless the people who are supporting Donald Trump are, and how much they're dictated by groupthink? Is that a form of, can that be a form of groupthink in itself?
Yeah. So this is part of, it's one thing to, like, you know, I study some of these things. People are influenced by leaders and groups. And that certainly, at least in the US, applies to a lot of vaccine resistant, but it, and obviously support for Trump or any leader. But it also is important to know, remember that there's huge diversity within groups. So let's just, like, look at people who haven't got a vaccine. At least in the US, some of them are not doing it because they're Republicans, and that's been kind of like been dismissive of COVID the entire time. It doesn't matter how many deaths, they'll just still be dismissive of it because it's part of their party identity. But some people just don't have easy access to it. They might be in rural areas. Some people have a pre-existing condition that they're worried about that might be affected by it. Or some people maybe would get it for themselves, but they're hesitant for their kids. They want to see more data. And so it's important to try to meet people where they are. And one thing that I'm fond of is trying to remove identity from the equation. So if you're going to try to convince somebody who is vaccine hesitant, try to take it out of the domain of an identity they have as an anti, don't call them an anti-vaxxer. Try to understand, okay, well, what are your concerns? Let them know that you're listening to them as an individual and that you hear them. And then try to address those concerns. And so that's, I think, like a tool of persuasion that is effective. And there's, you know, studies we cite on this and how it works is, a lot of times we lead with identity. especially in politics, we often, like, again, as I said, people put on their Twitter profiles as a kind of a bat signal, their signal identity. But if we lead with our identity, people might distrust us if it's not an identity they hold. And so we have to try to sometimes actually take that out of the equation or else appeal to a different identity. So I just saw a brand new paper on this. I believe it was a vaccine paper saying that if you appeal to people's parental concern about the health of their children, they're more willing to get a vaccine for their kid. So they, as I said, from the top, right, I have an identity, might have a political identity, but I also have a parent identity. And a lot of people's concerns are through parenting of wanting to make their kids safer. And if you can frame and explain to them how a vaccine will actually make their kids safer, which I know it will for both of mine, and I'm really excited, eager to get them vaccinated as soon as possible. I just got my daughter actually vaccinated last night for a flu shot because I'm like, not only want to protect her from the flu, but I want to get it at least 2 weeks before the COVID vaccine comes out so I can safely get her the COVID vaccine. And so my identity as a parent made me do that. And so you have to think about how to connect to people's identities in ways that are going to be motivating to them to do this, and then use good arguments as well. Obviously, most people are smart. And if they understand that most people are probably hearing a lot of misinformation about these topics. And if they can get some factual information in a way that's not threatening to their identity, that kind of 1-2 punch can help.
Yeah, and I think there's also a risk that not only can you label other people as anti-vax, but you can label yourself as pro-vaccine. And then that becomes such a strong part of your identity that you're just promoting vaccines like a religion instead of understanding the nuances of what's going on with other people, right?
Yeah, and I wouldn't promote a vaccine that hadn't been thoroughly vetted through massive clinical trials with random assignment and pre-registered analysis, and then further vetted by like an independent health panel. Yeah. So for me, the reason I trust it is because those vaccines have been vetted. Now they've been administered to billions of people. So we know that they're safe. That's overwhelming data. You'll never find that kind of data for almost anything else. And so I know by scientific standards, they're overwhelmingly safe, but I would not trust somebody to put a vaccine in my body that did not go through that vetting or anything in my body. So that is also something important to explain. A lot of people don't understand how that scientific process works. And you've seen really weird things. So in the US, we had this thing where everybody was taking ivermectin. These people who were vaccine resistant were looking for other medically vetted things. I had a family member who gave me a study on ivermectin trying to argue that it's good. Well, there was a study on it, but when I looked at that study, it was way less effective than the vaccines and way less scientifically rigorous in terms of how it had been vetted. So I would never take ivermectin over a vaccine. Even if it was effective, it's less effective and less rigorous in terms of the scientific process that's vetted it. And so anybody who's willing to take ivermectin should be theoretically willing to take a vaccine because the vaccines are far safer and far more effective. And so you have to kind of like walk through the process. A lot of people don't, how could they understand? Most people aren't scientists. But to me, I understand because I'm a scientist, so I can explain this to somebody, but you have to kind of meet people where they are. You understand that most people are getting misinformation. They want something. If they're getting ivermectin, means they want something to help them. They just don't know enough about how to vet it. And they're listening to probably low quality information sources about what's good and what's bad.
And so is that a case of, you talk about this, obviously, that the solution, and you know, we're in a time where people's identities are driving deep divisions. Is the solution to actively look for things you have in common? Like, you know, we're both dads. We both just want what's best for our kids, or we're both Americans. We both want what's best for the country, that kind of thing.
Yeah. I think you constantly have to make those shared identities salient. If you're, and then also further explain why the thing you want to do is actually helpful to that goal. And it's kind of, again, you need both pieces of it. You can't just say we're all Americans, so then trust me, or we're all Canadians, or we're all family. So you have to kind of do multiple stages. And I understand that there's some people who are just going to resist it. They're a little bit, like we have a chapter on cult psychology. Some people are really so deeply committed to an identity, and it might be an anti-vaxxer identity, that you're not going to get through to them. So you have to kind of sift through to find out who's open-minded and persuadable and maybe been fed misinformation versus who's really a deeply committed group member. Because the research on cult psychology finds are, you know, a lot of people like conspiracy theorists and so forth. If I, as an expert, challenge somebody who's a conspiracy theorist, they will then see it as evidence of the conspiracy, because that's how the structure of conspiracy theories is, that a bunch of connected, powerful people are out to trick you. me challenging them can be then seen as affirmation of that conspiracy theory. And so some of them, that's part of the challenge for some people. It might be very hard to convince them in a persuasive way. You kind of have to let them kind of support them in other ways to get out of that type of group identity and move into one that's more reality-based before you can start to make arguments to them.
Yeah, and that's how the media has kind of become irrelevant in American politics in a way, because it's been perceived as being part of the group that is trying to trick you or the group that's trying to persuade you, right? So I wanted to ask you about how this plays into how we respond from the perspective of charity and our philanthropy, because, for example, I'm sure you're aware of the story of the Humboldt Broncos in Canada, the hockey team, the junior hockey team that many members were killed and injured in a tragic collision with a truck. And my sense of that is that there was a huge groundswell of support for that team and for the family members and for the victims, because it was a very relatable story. It felt like it was happening, for lack of a better term, to the people who responded. It felt like it was happening to one of us. And there are other tragedies that happen that don't provoke that reaction and maybe deserve the same kind of attention, but don't get that same kind of attention. So is that an example of the kind of stuff you talk about?
Yeah. So we talk about pro-sociality helping, and including when bystanders jump in to help people who are in distress. I think the Humboldt tragedy resonated with people because a lot of Canadians have been on those buses, traveling on those icy roads in the middle of winter in the pitch black to go to hockey games and tournaments. I've been on, I can't tell you how many hours I've spent on a bus with my hockey team and the parents and in icy, treacherous roads. And you know, we take it for granted because it's part of the culture and part of the groups that we value. And so we resonate, that's us. It feels like, for many Canadians, it feels like us. And that's part of our identity and part of who we are. It's part of a cultural practice. And we have empathy for people who are similar than us. And there's research on this, that you're more willing to step in and help a stranger in distress if they're like you. So there was a study with, this was actually with football fans in the UK. You're more likely to help a fan wearing a jersey that from a team you support than a jersey from another team. But they ran another version of that study where instead of activating your identity as a fan of your favorite football team, they activated your identity as a fan of soccer. And when they did that, you helped anybody wearing a soccer jersey, even if it was your arch rival. And so we have to understand that we have the capacity to broaden our identities in ways that promote connection and helping of people who are different than us. And so I think that if you want to mobilize people, some identities are going to come naturally to them. The Humboldt one, just by the way the story's framed and presented, might seem so much like you that you instantly help and want to do something to make change and fundraise with your own team or give money. Other identities, you're going to have to remind people that they do have a connection to those people and should care about them. And that's going to be more effortful. And so that's something that we can do as individuals. We can remind ourselves we have broader identities and we'd want those people to help us. Or if you're a leader or a manager, you can think about how what identities we share and make those salient when you're communicating the story to make people care more about helping. And so you shouldn't just say people are callous, because the studies find that people can be enormously generous as long as they see the connection. And that's, again, it's too bad that the human brain is wired that way. I wish we helped all strangers, but it's not. And so people do have this capacity for enormous charity and generosity if you can activate a shared sense of identity with them. So I want to like think of humans in the most generous way and think that since we have this potential and we are willing to do it, we should just be more mindful of it and do what we can to activate it. And so if you're fundraising or doing a charity, think carefully about that framing and do it in ways that resonate with people.
Yeah. And so, you know, what I find fascinating about your work, Jay, is that it almost becomes a lens through which you see everything differently, right? That you see what people's motivations are and you can start to understand why they make certain decisions. And then you can apply that knowledge to how you choose to influence them, right? And I don't mean that in a manipulative way, but if we are all trying to convince people to buy our book or listen to what we have to say or join our movement or whatever. And understanding the group dynamics that drive so much of human behavior is essential to that, right? So so what advice do you have for people on how to apply this?
Yeah, I mean, the first thing is, I would say, read the book. I have a cousin who's an engineer, lives in Vancouver, and would never otherwise read any of my research. And he read the book a couple weeks ago. And he said it was very much like taking the red pill, you know, in the Matrix, where you start to see the world through a whole different lens. And it, he's like, it makes so much sense to me, like politics, all these other things that we're dealing with in society once I read the book. So that's the first thing. We just want to give people the tools to understand how what's going on. We want to give people the tools to understand how they're being influenced. And so then they can embrace that if they want or not. And then the final thing is we want to give people the tools to influence. And when I autograph the book, people ask me for autographed or sign it for them. I often say, use the power of us for good, not evil. So what we want to do is give the tools to people to make a better world. We want organizations to be better. I want organizations to be more inclusive of different people. I want them to be more inclusive of debate and dissent and different ideas, because it will make them better. Our research shows it'll make them more innovative and collectively intelligent. It will make people more comfortable saying opinions that otherwise would get suppressed. It will make the businesses more successful because they'll have people working together for success. And so whether you're, you know, again, a CEO running a nonprofit or a large organization, or you're in government, you're a deputy director, or you're, you know, coaching your daughter's hockey team, I think that these principles could be used for all kinds of worlds. And I use them in my own lab. One of the reasons that I've had a very successful lab in terms of our research and productivity, and my students are successful and happy, is because I use these principles when I run my lab in my lab meeting. We've created symbols of identity. The way I talk is we share every paper for everybody's criticism. I have ways of embedding democracy in decision-making. So we'll do anonymous votes because sometimes it's hard to speak up if you don't agree, but you can get a temperature of the room if you do a quick 10-minute anonymous poll on something. And so I try to understand I have a position of power to create the norms, even within my own team. I don't run the university, but I run a research team of 20 or 30 people to create the norms where everybody can be successful and have voice and be included. And so we all have influence over small groups of people in ways that are profound and we don't often understand. And so this is like I use all the principles of my management style from science. I don't just make them up based on my gut intuition or what I saw one other person do. I do them based on what the research suggests would be the most effective way. And then on average over time, it's more effective.
Yeah. And you know, I think the key is to do it in a way that is generating the positive benefits of group dynamics without demonizing people who aren't in the group or discriminating against them. That's the part that I think is critical, right? So
yeah, I think those are the people who face the most barriers, and they're the people we should be paying attention to.
Very quickly before we let you go, Jay, you co-authored this book, and is it true that when you first met your co-author, first of all, you didn't get along very well at first, and then he actually ended up kind of saving your life? Is that right?
Yeah. So when I moved to Toronto, I was told by my advisor when I started my PhD, pick an office somewhere in the basement. And I found a room. There's three desks in it. There's only one other student. His name was Dominic Packer. And I grabbed the desk. I don't think he was too excited because he had a whole office room to himself, which was quite luxurious for a graduate student. And all of a sudden he had to share it now with somebody. And then the other thing I did by the second day, I realized I had a tiny apartment in Toronto. And so I had no room for my goalie equipment because I'm a hockey player, or was until that stage. And so I brought my hockey bag to the office because it was the only place where I could put it. And that made him really despise me because he did not share my identity as a hockey player. He was not a hockey player. The thought of a big stinky goalie equipment bag in the office was deeply disconcerting to him. So that was, I completely alienated him. And then it was a few months later that we were at a talk after a speaker came to the university where we're chatting, and we were both poor graduate students. So there's free food there. And so I'm having a free beer and eating cheese cubes. And one got stuck in my throat and I started choking and I couldn't breathe. You know, eventually I tried to wash it down with beer and my 100% of the oxygen to my brain was cut off. And I used to work in the oil field. And so I've taken, you know, dozens of safety classes you have to do if you work there. And one of my lessons I remember learning about, if someone's choking, the tendency is, it's embarrassing, deeply embarrassing. Your tendency is to avoid embarrassment because you want to not lose status in your group, to go to the washroom or somewhere private and try to deal with it. But that's how you die. If you're ever choking and you do that, that increases your chances dramatically you'll die, because most people know how to do the Heimlich. And so I wanted to leave the room because it was 50 people, mostly professors, who are high status. I was low status. And it was mortifyingly embarrassing. But I stayed in the room and I got the bartender help a little bit to try to dislodge it. But then I was still choking. So I grabbed Dominic's hand and brought him to the washroom. And he didn't really know what he was doing, but eventually he got going and I put his hands in the right spot and he did the Heimlich and it came out. And spared me embarrassment because it was mostly in private in the men's room. And from that moment on, we shared a bond because we'd gone through an intense experience. He started to see me as someone who he had some closeness to. Turns out doing a favor for somebody, especially an extreme experience like that, increases a sense of shared purpose and identity. And from that moment on, we would talk in the office, share ideas, and we started collaborating. And he's the person who really got me deep into social identity theory. And so we became lifelong collaborators. So that was 18 years ago, and we're still working together. And I think the moment we traced to us getting along together was going through this near-death experience over me choking on a cubed piece of cheese. So
yeah.
The other lesson from my book is don't eat cubed cheese and don't leave the room if you're choking.
Yeah. Great advice.
That's the best advice from my whole book.
Yeah. The result is a lifelong collaboration, including this new book. So congratulations on that. Jay, this is fascinating stuff. I love it. I could talk about it for ages, but I've already learned so much from this conversation. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me, Mark. And if anybody wants to learn more about the book and order it or read some reviews, we have it on powerofus.online, where you can go and check it out. And it's sold wherever books are sold.
That's Jay Van Bavel, co-author of The Power of Us and associate professor of psychology and neuroscience at New York University. I really learned a lot from this conversation. I just love that reminder that there is both benefit and risk to how we align ourselves with other people. I also like what Jay said about how we have to think about how we influence others and not just how they influence us. I actually did an exercise with a group of people around that recently, and it was really interesting for everyone to realize how they were helping and impacting others and not just being impacted by them. And I'm also grateful that Jay actually provides some suggestions on how we can turn his research into something positive, because we hear a lot about the negative effects of group dynamics right now. So once again, a big thank you to Jay for being with us on Digging Deep. And if you enjoyed this episode, I have a favor to ask you. Please review it on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen, and send it to a couple of people you think would find it interesting. That's going to help us reach more people and produce more great episodes. And one last thing, if you want to keep digging deep into topics and lessons like this, subscribe to my weekly newsletter. I send it out every week. I know you probably get a lot of stuff already in your inbox, but this is very quick. It's right to the point. It's 5 very short items that I've discovered each week. It'll take you about 2 minutes to read. And it has some great lessons from experts that you can apply right away. If you want to subscribe or check it out, go to letsdigdeep.com. That's letsdigdeep.com. And get ready for more great stories and powerful lessons on the next edition of Digging Deep. Thank you for listening.
Have you ever thought, I'd love to have a podcast just like this one? Well, I can help. My name is Matt Kundle, and everyone at my company, the Sound Off Podcast Network, had a hand in making this show. Whether it was about the sound, the discoverability, or that you're just enjoying the show, we are all about the detail. If you think you have a podcast in you, reach out to me via email, matt@soundoff.network. Or check out the website and become one of the great podcasts we work with at soundoff.network.